If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
One thing that I loved doing was getting candles from Bath & Body Works. And those were some of my, like, most viewed videos. And now I get to make the fragrances that I've always wanted to smell but haven't smelled in candles before.
If you've ever wondered how people make a career out of posting videos of their everyday life on YouTube and what happens when they get sick of it and quit, this is the episode for you. My guest, Ingrid Nilsson, was one of the quintessential YouTube stars of the 2010s.
My name is Ingrid Nilsson. I use she, her pronouns. I am a mixed race queer woman living in Brooklyn, New York.
Known for her candid girl next door vibe with videos about how to do makeup, what to wear, and things like how to work out if you hate working out. She shared almost everything with her 8 million followers, including coming out as gay at the age of 26. And then in 2020, at the age of 31, despite making really good money at the time, she just quit YouTube. Full stop. Was not interested anymore. Cut to, she now runs a fragrance company, The New Savant, with her partner.
I am currently in my studio where we make our candles for the business that I am a co-founder in, The New Savant.
I just want to know, how do you come down off of such an incredible but evidently unsustainable fortune-making career? I'm Maya Lau, and this is Other People's Pockets, the show where I ask people how much they make and how their finances work, so the questions we all have about money can be a little bit less of a mystery. Ingrid, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
Can you tell me what your path was to becoming a creative and a maker?
So I started my YouTube channel in 2009, and I quit my YouTube career in June 2020. So I was on the platform for a long time before it became a job for people and people were making money off of posting videos. And really what led me to making YouTube videos was just the really rough nature of my teen years. So there was a lot of personal turmoil and financial turmoil in my teen years because my mom was sick with breast cancer all throughout my high school years, and she was the main breadwinner in our family. And then my junior year of high school, my dad suddenly died. And it was really just a tumultuous time in my life, especially when my peers were, you know, having their first dates and they were looking forward to prom and all of these things. And I felt like I was putting on a mask when I would go out in public and then I would come home and just be in all of these really complicated feelings. And so I really leaned on my creativity in those moments. I've always been creative and I really thank my dad for that. I grew up around him painting. I grew up a lot around art. And I was just always really encouraged to be creative. And so when I barely graduated from high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was like, how the hell am I supposed to know what to do with my life? I started going on the internet more. So I became curious about makeup, and I discovered these women from all over the world making videos, often in their bedroom, about beauty and makeup, and it was all stuff that they bought themselves, and they were trying it out and sharing their opinions on it. And it was a whole new world for me because I was so used to seeing magazines where a lot of the people featured were blonde-haired white women, and a lot of the products were for blonde-haired white women or just white women in general. And it was incredible to see these women that I could relate to. I remember watching one woman in particular. She lived in Singapore, and I was like, oh my God, I had no idea about any of these brands that are made by Asian companies for Asian women. And it just like opened up a whole new world for me. So that's really how I got into making YouTube videos. I started as someone who was watching.
Mm-hmm. And you started right after you graduated high school?
So that was in 2009. So 2 years after I graduated from high school, I was at a community college. And I really was just, it just wasn't connecting for me. I think because I was still dealing with a lot of the stuff that had happened in my teen years, I just didn't know how to navigate it all. And so I really leaned on the community that I found on the internet.
And did you feel a tension of like, okay, put myself out there, but like, I also want to hide and be private. And why did I put that out there? Did you feel that, or did you feel kind of like, no, this feels good. This feels like where I can really be me?
Well, it was definitely weird filming for the first time, especially not knowing how to be on camera.
Yeah.
What to even, you realize, oh my gosh, now I have to speak.
Yeah.
I would say like the very first video I created was pretty authentic because it's, I'm really sad because I deleted it pretty early on because I was like, whatever, I'm just going to delete this, not thinking that it would be something that I want to look back on. But I really didn't talk very much in my first video because I didn't know what to do. You know, I didn't know how to carry a storyline or engage with the camera. And so it really was strange for me. And I actually think it really helped me in terms of my social anxiety because I learned how to speak in the privacy of my own space. And then I could take those skills into public settings where in the past I would be really nervous. And it helped me just communicate with people in person a lot more. But yeah, it was definitely weird. And you know, it took many years to figure out what my boundaries were in terms of what I shared online and what I didn't, because I was in this as this space was evolving. And so I was also like 20 years old when I started, so I didn't know what any, you know, kind of repercussions would be. I just wasn't thinking about any of that. I was just doing what felt right in that moment.
And And so you were about 2 years out of high school when you started. And then at what point did you start making money off of your channel?
I can't remember the exact timeline, but sometime within the first 2 years, I remember at that time you had to apply to AdSense and connect your channel. And I remember doing that and then not even knowing how to look at my account on the back end to see how much money I had made. And I had been accepted. And then months later, I finally figured out how to, you know, see the back end. And I saw that I had like $500 in my account. And I was like, oh my God, where did this come from? And then it was, how do I get the $500 like on my YouTube screen to then go into my bank account? So that was like a whole other thing. But I just remember being in shock.
And like during this time, are you like you're in community college? Are you working jobs like normal jobs? Like how long before you could, I'm guessing at some point, quit like a normal job?
Yeah, I was working in retail and I spent my days folding clothes, checking people out at the cash register. I was still working that job definitely in the first year and probably into the second year. It took a while to be able to make, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 a month off of YouTube videos alone because I wasn't doing any kind of branded content. This was just from AdSense. So I remember I would, you know, get ready for work. Make a video really quickly, go off to work, come back, often film another video to have, go to bed, wake up and like do the same thing all over again. So I was really trying to like squeeze in making content wherever I could. I mean, I started because I loved it. And then when I saw that $500, I was like, I would much rather be doing this. Than going into a store every day where you're dealing with customers that aren't treating you nicely and all sorts of things. And I also wasn't getting paid well. I was like, this is so much better. Like, I could do something that I really like that challenges me creatively and make money off of it. And so I remember I waited until I was making about like $2,000 to $3,000 a month to quit my job to then pursue YouTube full time.
So you said you quit your job like when you're making like $3,000 a month-ish. So that's like $36,000 a year. Was there any point where it was like, this is not just I'm making a living, like this is like a lot of money?
This actually happened in the form of essentially a grant. So in 2011, I want to say it was.
And at this point, you were what age?
21, 22. I entered myself into YouTube's Next Up contest, and it was YouTube's first year doing this contest where they were trying to find up-and-coming talent on the platform and really foster these smaller creators. And part of the winnings was going to New York City and going through a 5-day YouTube camp. And I was one of the winners of this contest. So we had to submit like different videos within they had these rules and, you know, we had to submit different kinds of videos and then they were voted on by the public and also people at YouTube. And there were three different rounds and I ended up being one of the winners. I think there were about 15 of us who won and we all got flown to New York City for this 5-day YouTube camp where they brought in, you know, like the top YouTubers at the time, which you could count like on one hand to come in and talk to us about like what they had learned. They brought in different business people. So I learned a lot there. But one of the most meaningful things that happened was at the end of that trip, they gave each one of us an envelope with a check for $35,000 in cash. And I was like, what? I've never seen this kind of money before. Like, and I'm supposed to fly back to Los Angeles with this check just casually in my bag. And I remember the entire flight just constantly opening up my bag to make sure it was there because I was just like shaking. I was so scared that I was going to lose it or something was going to happen to it. I had never seen that kind of money in my life. And I couldn't believe that I was in charge of it. Like, it was my responsibility to, like, get it home and then put it in the bank. And there were no strings attached. So that was a really incredible thing that they never did again, which, honestly, I think they should, because that was one of the most valuable things that helped accelerate my career, because I was able to move out of my mom's house and my childhood bedroom. And we also got gift cards for equipment. And so it gave me this financial boost that I needed to fully invest in making content full time.
Can you give us a sense of, like, you know, by this point I was making this much money and then, you know, I'm sure it went up and down. Like, can you give us just like a little bit of a sense of like how your income grew, what it grew to, what it went down to, and when, and how that all worked?
Yeah. So by the mid 2010s, I would say at 2014, I was making close to $1 million a year. And then at my peak, which would have been around like 2016-ish, bringing in $2.1 million, like as a business. My takeaway was
all
not
Right. That's all the revenue. And then there's expenses after that.
Yeah. But it was still a lot of money.
Yeah.
Even though it's being dispersed in different, you know, their legal fees, taxes, employees, I consistently made around $2 million for about 2 to 3 years. And before that, leading up to that, it was, you know, about $1 million. And then after, at the end of my YouTube career, it was about $950,000.
Wow. Yeah. What were some of your expenses? Did you have a lot of employees? Did you, like, just give us a sense of, like, what did your whole business look like?
So it fluctuated. There was definitely a point at the most expensive point where I was also making the most money, that $2 million point. I had a full-time shooter and editor. So, you know, shooting pretty much every video that I made, editing it. I had a full-time production manager who helped me, you know, work with the shooter and editor and get, like, materials ready, work with my manager, so my talent manager, and the sales team to work with brands. So any kind of branded content, my production manager was involved. My talent manager was involved. There were legal fees, so a lawyer. So any kind of like brand deal always had to go through the legal channels, which is also, you know, it's an expense that adds up. I also eventually brought on, like around this time, hired a business manager to help manage all of the finances and payroll. And then I also had another production assistant. So that is an overview of what, like, the immediate team looked like on a daily basis, like at that peak point.
And so then after you subtract all of that and there's, you know, yeah, all those expenses, like, how much would you say you were actually taking home at your peak?
I'm trying to remember, less than 500 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say probably somewhere around 300,000 to 400,000. Yeah, around 400,000 feels right.
Being the kind of YouTube star that you were, is the money in the endorsements, in the ads, like where was like most of the money coming from?
Before the 2 million point, so when I was less than a million, around the million mark, I would say that it was pretty split between what I was making on AdSense and what I was doing for brands.
Mm-hmm.
And then AdSense really started to change because more people were coming to the platform. And so that means that the money has to be distributed more, which is great. I am a huge believer in that. And it also meant that I had to think about different ways to bring in money. And that's when endorsements were really starting to grow. Brands were interested in working with creators. And so then it switched, and the majority of my income, the vast majority, was coming from brand endorsements, in-person events, etc.
Mm-hmm. And at the peak, in order to bring in $2 million in revenue, how many followers did you have?
I had 8 million followers across my social platforms.
And what was your mom's reaction when you were making millions of dollars?
My mom was like, what the hell is going on? I did not come to this country for you to just like screw around on the internet. And like, I don't think she ever fully grasped exactly what was going on. All she knew at that point was my daughter is sitting in the bathroom, in her bedroom, in these different places, filming videos, putting them up on YouTube. She knew how to get to them on YouTube and somehow is making money off of this.
Mm-hmm.
I remember doing my taxes for the first time, like after making YouTube money, and like the tax guy was like so confused. And right. I was like, I'm so confused too. This is my first time doing this. And I have to like describe to him what I'm doing. He's trying to understand. It was just a whole confusing situation. My mom was confused, I think, still logistically about how it was all happening, but she was really happy for me because she wanted me to have some kind of financial stability and to have financial independence. And so when she saw me achieve that, albeit in this unexpected way, she was happy for me and I think relieved too.
Can you talk about what your upbringing around money was and what socioeconomic class you considered yourself?
So my mom is a Thai woman and she worked at a bank, and I remember it was always her dream to like make $50,000 a year. And she was supporting a family of four in California, but she never made $50,000. So I think like the max amount that she made was $30,000, and then into the 40s when I got a little bit older. But I remember there was a lot of financial stress because it was my mom, my dad, my grandmother, and myself. So obviously a kid is expensive no matter what. And then my grandmother was aging, so there were costs associated with that. And then my dad was also older, so the cost of him getting older, not being able to work full-time like he used to. And so my mom was really bringing in most of that money. And so we didn't live in poverty, but it mm-hmm. was really just, you know, the food that we needed to live, the clothes to wear. And like, I mean, I can count on one hand the amount of vacations that we went on as a family, and they were always within drivable distance. Like, we would go, like, up the coast and stay in a hotel and, like, walk around a town. So, like, once I got to a certain age and I could, like, understand more, like, what my parents were talking about, I could tell that there was a lot of stress on my mom in order to support the family. And then when she got diagnosed with cancer, I had just started my freshman year of high school. She couldn't work at all. The minute that she felt like any kind of like strength to like go to the office, she had to take it because she needed to like make the money in order to like support the family. I think that my mom, being a woman of color, she has brown skin. She wasn't respected at her job like some of her other coworkers were, and was not given pay raises, was not given the understanding when she was literally going through cancer treatments. So that was like a huge stress when she was sick. And then when my dad suddenly died my junior year, that put even more stress on the situation. He didn't have life insurance. And this is so naive, and it sounds so silly when I say it out loud, but this is the reference that I had. On TV and in movies, when someone dies, I was used to seeing the story of like, oh, they get like money from that. Like when someone dies, you like inherit some money. But that was not the case. Like we lost money when my dad died because of all of the expenses. When I could start working, even driving, I felt a responsibility. Like I need to be able to drive because my mom can't, she doesn't have the time to do this. She's not healthy enough to do this. I remember I was driving around illegally for at least 6 months because there was no other way for me to get around. And that was like a huge, just, I think, awakening for me in terms of like how I had, what I had considered my norm growing up and what my new normal was like when I started making my own money.
I know that I would feel very self-conscious if there was a lot of content out about me from 10, 15 years ago. Like, I'd be like, I'm not like that anymore, whatever. What is that all like?
I mean, it's definitely weird. It's weird that, like, you know, so much of me growing up is out there. And in general, sharing so much of just like my everyday mundane life, that is really like what took a toll on me. Like doing the series Vlogmas on my YouTube channel, which was making a video every single day in the month of December up until December 25th. Not only was that a, you know, physical toll, but it was also a really mental and emotional toll because in order to create that level of content, I had to be showing areas of my life that I just wouldn't want to show now. You know, I remember showing myself like doing the dishes and just having these like otherwise like boring moments, but they're your private moments that you just have with yourself. And I think my regret is just not valuing privacy more when I was younger because I didn't fully understand it. I really had to like cross that boundary in order to understand what my boundaries like even were. I think also the one upside of being public facing for me was that it really encouraged me to be my most authentic self. And for that part of it, I am so grateful. Like, I don't think I would have come out as soon as I did, which is considered late, like coming out late in your mid-20s. But I think it would have taken me even longer to come out. And now I'm just like, that was my life. What happened was part of my life story, and I continue to learn from my life experience.
Mm.
What was the decision to announce that you're retiring to, A, make it so final, and, like, you were making serious money? So tell me about that decision.
I loved what I did for such a long period of time, which mm-hmm. I'm so grateful for. But then it got to a point where I had done what I had set out to do and then some. And I was just like, this just isn't for me anymore. Like, I am just at the point where I don't want to do this anymore. It is so taxing on me emotionally and mentally to do this every single day. And I wanted to be just like a private person in the world and not mm-hmm. have to be this like public figure. This is a lucrative career, and the financial stability that it gave me absolutely changed my life. I didn't have to keep doing it mm-hmm. like for those reasons. And I ultimately decided that I have savings, I can quit, and I have so many skills that I learned because of this mm-hmm. job, and I can do something else.
How would you say that it relates or doesn't relate to your current business, the New Savant?
Well, I have always loved fragrance. And in my early YouTube days, one thing that I loved doing was getting candles from Bath & Body Works. And those were some of my, like, most viewed videos because, like, Bath & Body Works had such a hold on so many of us, whether we were wearing, like, the body sprays. And then I always had a candle burning in the background of my videos. And so throughout the life of my channel, I was always exploring fragrance and candles in different ways. And so now I own a fragrance business right now. So it completely makes sense to me that this is what I'm doing now because I've had such a strong love and appreciation for fragrance and specifically candles for a really long time. And now I get to make the fragrances that I've always wanted to smell but haven't smelled in candles before.
I'm just curious if you can talk more about, like, why is fragrance so important to you and your customers?
It is so emotional and it's so personal. And there's a lot to unpack with fragrance. And I think it's one of the frontiers that have not been explored deeply in terms of just like the knowledge that we have around fragrance. It's historically been seen as the least important scent, and yet it is the strongest scent that we have from the time that we're born up until the age of 10 when sight and sound take over, and our preferences are being developed really strongly in those first 10 years. We hold prejudices based off of our fragrance preferences. And so, because the fragrance industry is very Eurocentric, there are a lot of cis, straight, white French men who have told us for hundreds of years what smells good mm-hmm. and what doesn't smell good. That has informed Western culture specifically, it has informed what is considered a good smell and what is considered a bad smell. And I work with two female perfumers at our fragrance house. And, you know, I'm creating fragrances that not only I haven't smelled before in candles, but are also related to my life experience. So, for example, there's one candle called Mixed Feelings, and it blends my Norwegian and Thai heritage. So I really wanted a strong note of steamed rice in that candle, combined with heather, which is a flower of Norway, jasmine, incense, because I grew up going to the Thai temple with my grandmother. When you smell that candle, you smell the rice. Yeah. And it is so unusual to many people because they're not used to smelling steamed rice in general. But let alone in a candle. Yeah. And the response from people has been really interesting because it is one of our most polarizing scents. And a lot of people who have a similar background to mine smell it, and it smells like home, or it smells like a very specific memory they had. People who have not had a similar life experience often smell that and have like a very strong negative response to the fragrance. Mm-hmm. And you cannot deny that that is based in certain prejudices and things that we have learned as we have grown up in whatever like culture that we grow up in. And the exciting thing is you're not stuck with the preferences that you formed from the time that you were born to age 10. You can create new neural pathways. You can learn to like scents that you previously have not liked. Like, we could smell a new smell every minute of every day for the rest of our lives and still never smell like every scent combination possible. Mm-hmm. So there's so much possibility. There's so much room for so many more stories to be told through fragrance. When we think of fragrance, we automatically think of Europe as like inventing fragrance. It's so not true, because a lot of the ingredients that they were using came from other countries like Asia.
Right.
And so it's like, you didn't invent it. But yet they're the ones that are celebrated.
Right. As always,
so
co-opted
now,
it from others and repackaged it. How do you think about your desirability or your attractiveness, like being a way that people know you and like you make money and it's part of your career? Even now, I mean, your face is out there. How do you think about all that?
It's definitely different now as opposed to then, where like I was in the beauty industry and my face was the product. Like, I was the product. I was talking about products, but really I was the product. And that was really difficult for me. And one of the reasons why I quit was because I didn't want to be a product anymore. I didn't want a career that was just like based off of how likable I was and how I looked, because it didn't feel in line with who I am. I got so much positive feedback from that career. I got financial stability. It changed my life in so many positive ways, but also that didn't feel good. And I don't want to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was going to do next, but I knew that I didn't want to live the rest of my life with essentially a worry and a concern about like how I look and am I going to be able to make money because I have wrinkles underneath my eyes or whatever. I didn't want that to be a part of my job anymore. Mm-hmm. I remember also post coming out, the beauty industry, a lot of the executives at that time, the people higher up in companies, were mostly men. And like after I came out, there was definitely a difference in terms of who I was working with. And, you know, I think that is definitely in line with like, if you are perceived or known to be queer, you are more likely to get paid less or not get a job because of that. That was definitely my experience, because all of a sudden I'm being removed from that like heteronormative cis male world. And it's like, we don't have use for you anymore.
And how much money do you make now?
So last year I made $65,000.
And that's what you took home, or?
That's what I took home. Mm-hmm. The business itself made over $500,000. So just over $500,000. I didn't take payments for about 9 months of last year. So what I made was really in the last part of the year, which is our biggest time of the year, being a candle business. Mm-hmm. That last part of the year is like candle season.
Yeah.
But that is what I made. And I was able to put off payments from the company because I had savings from mm-hmm. my YouTube career.
Do you feel comfortable talking about your savings and your net worth?
Yeah. So when I quit YouTube, I had about $560,000 cash in savings. And then a portion of that had to go to taxes. So about $100,000-ish had to go to taxes. And then I also was in the process of hunting down some payments that were owed to me, which took a full year to get everything paid out. Then I had equity in a company, and I had had this equity since 2016, and I had decided to, instead of getting paid as I would for any other kind of like brand partnership, I would take equity in the company instead of payment. And it worked out that after I quit YouTube, the company sold and I got over $500,000 from that stake in equity. So it really set me up for mm-hmm. this next chapter. I wasn't expecting it to come at the time that it did, but it was like amazing timing. So I had to pay taxes on that. And then the taxes that I had from my YouTube money, but I was still left with almost $1 million in cash, not including mm-hmm. the 401k, which was about $400,000. So that really set me up to like start this business with my own money. I have put in about $30,000 of my own cash into the business in $10,000 increments over time. I've been able to forego getting paid in order to help the business grow and pay employees. And this is the first year where I'm getting a consistent salary. So I am now getting paid $7,000 a month. The $7,000 a month that I'm going to be making this year covers like my immediate life costs that are in front of me, whether it's like paying for my insurance, my space that I live in, my apartment, et cetera, like food. It covers like those immediate costs, but anything else I have to like dip into my savings. And so I would like to be in a place where I don't have to be dipping mm-hmm. into my savings. But if everything disappeared, I could lean on my savings to keep living.
What does enough look like to you?
Where I am right now, I totally have enough.
Ingrid, thank you so much for talking to me. This was really awesome.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Other People's Pockets. And hey, this is still a new show, and if you like it, it really helps us if you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Other People's Pockets is written and hosted by me, Maya Lau. It's produced by me along with Joy Sanford and Dan Gallucci. Production help from Angela Vang. Our executive producers are me along with Jane Marie and Dan Gallucci. Special thanks to Steamed Rice. Other People's Pockets is a co-production of Pushkin Industries and Little Everywhere. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you love the show, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus, offering bonus content and ad-free listening across our network for $4.99 a month. Look for the Pushkin Plus channel on Apple Podcasts or at pushkin.fm. You can sign up for Pushkin newsletters at pushkin.fm. Find me on Twitter at Maya Lau or on Instagram and TikTok at It's Maya Money. And one more thing, we would love to hear from you, OPP listeners. Tell us, what would you spend serious money on if it existed? Like an invention that you would create if you could. Leave us a voicemail at 323-540-4255, letting us know your thoughts. That's 323-540-4255. Or record a voice memo on your phone and send it to otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com.